Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Doing great. Doing great.
Well, I'm doing great, too.
Doing great things. I'm not just doing great. I'm doing great things.
Yeah, let's report to our listeners that people like you who listen to us on podcasts and on the radio in the New Jersey listening area and throughout the country and throughout the world have made a difference. We've had on a number of folks from a group called Oceana. Oceana.org is where you can find them. You can get on their mailing list. They do a lot of great work about preserving our ability. And remember, Mark and I are environmentalists who like to eat food. We just like our children and grandchildren to also be able to eat some of the foods. One of the most wasteful fishing practices out there, one of the largest impact fishing practices, is fishing for shark.
Shark finning.
Well, because most of the shark fishing is done for finning. And what they do, and there's a big demand in Asian markets and in Japan especially, for shark fin soup.
Well, so we're not the only wasteful country in the world.
See, now
there are others as well.
See, now the shark fin is very expensive, but shark meat in general not very expensive, and it's thought to have, you know, make you masculine and give you, you know, whatever kind of powers that, you know, whatever. Hogwash. Anyway, but shark fin soup, the way the boats go out, because they can get such premium for the shark fin and the whole shark takes up such room on the boat, they harvest the sharks, cut off the fins, and throw the sharks back in the water to die. I mean, so you're killing a very large animal for a very small piece of meat and just leaving it in the ocean floor. And you know, when you get into the top of the food chain like that and you take a huge predator like that of the ocean, you make a monstrous difference in the ecosystem of the oceans. Anyway, there's a movement against shark fin soup. We had one victory when Disney in their, you know, Asia land at Epcot Center stopped serving shark fin soup for weddings and in their Japanese restaurants, which was great. And Amazon.com has recently agreed, under pressure from all people like you who call them, they no longer sell shark fin soup. It's taken off of Amazon.com.
And I guess the irony for me here is, you know, I want you to serve shark fin soup, but only if you've harvested the whole shark.
Right, but that's not happening, so we can't
do that. It's,
if you're out shark fishing, you take a whole shark, you use it all, then you can serve the shark fin soup.
Exactly.
So, anyway, so that's one victory. Another victory that was reported in January, Smithfield Foods in January, the nation's largest pork producer with 1.2 million breeding sows, announced that it will phase out the confinement of pigs in gestation crates, which is where they put them when they're gestating, and it'll phase that out over the next decade. We'll keep their feet to the fire on that one.
Because the decade's a long period.
But that was in response to some ballot initiatives in Arizona and Florida, where the Humane Society of the United States led the way for breeding pigs. In 2002, Florida voters approved a ban on gestation crates, and then in 2006, Arizona voters did the same in spite of very well-financed opposition from factory farming interests. These are 2-foot by 7-foot metal cages used to confine breeding pigs for months and months.
You know what? And Smithfield Farms is pretending to serve some of the highest quality hams in the country. If you're serving from CFOs from
confinement animal feeding operations,
you know, there's no way you're one of the premier pork producers.
But hey, let's
not
bash them today. Let's congratulate them.
Okay, congratulations. You may once again become one of the premier ham producers in the country.
Well, I want to share with our listeners something else. We'd like to encourage you to go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We sent out an email about a benefit that we're doing for some friends of ours, people we know, who have a child who is afflicted with a disease.
Eosinophilic
enteropathy. I think I got that right. It's eosinophilic enteropathy. EE from now on is how I'm calling it.
I'll tell you that it's a very rare disease, and even I have some gastroenterologists who are customers are like, listen, even I don't know anything about this.
This is a disease where Hunter Morris, who's now 3 years old, he cannot digest protein. He can't eat regular food. And he's never been able to eat regular food, not mother's milk, not nothing. He survives now on an elemental formula that's already broken the proteins down into amino acids.
And actually, slowly through some treatments, he is now able. There are six or eight foods that he's able to eat, but there are no proteins in those foods. And so now there are some things that he can actually start to eat, and they're hoping that this is something that can get better. But
now listen,
probably not.
If you want to find out more about this, go to restaurantguysradio.com and you can find the link. I want to be sure that I'm going to say that a few times. I'm going to mention it through the show. But his parents are blue collar people. You know, his mom has to stay home full time with him. He can't even touch other kids after they've eaten until they watch.
Mm-hmm.
He has external reactions, is allergic to a lot of stuff. All of these things can be life-threatening. And it's a full-time job to take care of him. His dad works in a print shop. And, you know, the elemental formula that he eats is $1,500 a month. One of the doctors they need to see on a regular basis is out in, where is it, Mark, in the Midwest somewhere?
Cincinnati.
In Cincinnati. They got to fly the whole family
and
out
for,
there.
For actually now, some, apparently, they can see somebody in New York City. But for the first 2.5 years, they had to fly the whole family out
they
to Cincinnati.
They have another kid that they had to get on the plane.
For treatments.
Stay in a hotel.
Just very difficult.
Anyway.
A lot of expenses, many more expenses than they could possibly handle.
And it looks like Hunter will soon not be able to eat enough formula to meet his nutritional needs, and at that point he may have to have a tube inserted so that he can be tube fed maybe for the rest of his life. This is a printer and his wife who just can't afford this, and even though they have medical insurance, they're working full time with the copays, with the travel, with the stuff that's not covered, they're going broke.
They're past going broke.
And well, yeah. That's... Well, anyway, so a bunch of their friends set up the Hunter Morris Fund. You can go to huntermorrisfund.com, or you can link to it through restaurantguysradio.com. We're going to do a fundraiser for them at Catherine Lombardi. $100 a person to come down, and those of us who take so much enjoyment from eating are going to get together and do some good for a kid who can't and his family who's trying to keep the family together. Now, $100 buys you dinner. And wine. Wine's been donated by a number of great winemakers.
Really good winemakers. George Hendry's involved. Schutzolz is involved.
Some
Macari's
of the
involved.
Kathy
Long
Corson,
Island.
I believe, is involved.
Kathy Corson, I believe, has donated some things for us.
Some of the food has been donated by some of our great purveyors, like D'Artagnan and some of the other purveyors. And Mark and I, 100% of the donation goes to the Hunter Morris Fund. Mark and I are not keeping anything. We're going to donate whatever's not covered. And it's, I don't even know if you know this, Mark, but a couple of our waiters have said they're going to...
Volunteered, I do know this.
You'll pay a tip, but they're going to donate their tips also to the Hunter Morris Fund. So, and we're also going to have a live auction. A lot of these wineries have donated some extraordinary, and listen, we're very jaded people, extraordinary bottles of wine, golf for two, Rutgers tickets.
All sorts of things. There are bottles of wine that would retail for about $40-$50. There are bottles of wine that would retail for over $1,000.
And
Fours Gates donated a couple of foursomes for four. Knob Hill Golf has donated a golf outing for 12. Rutgers has donated a ton of stuff, golf camps, football camps, baseball camps, soccer camps. The soccer coach has been very generous.
So the Hunter Morris fundraiser is going to be at Catherine Lombardi on the 19th. That's the week after Valentine's Day.
President's Day, February 19th.
If you can come, that'd be great. You can call us at 732-296-9463. That's the restaurant. You can go to CatherineLombardi.com or RestaurantGuysRadio.com and find out if you can make it or just come to – if you come the way the auction to bid on as well. Or if you just want to make a donation, you can go to either one of our websites, and that'll link you right to the HunterMorrisFund.com, and you can just make a donation right online.
And remember, this is all tax-deductible. All the money you're giving to us, you can actually, when you come to the dinner, if you write your checks directly to the Hunter Morris Fund, you can deduct the whole thing.
Yeah, all the checks can, exactly. And if you can't, we'll give you a letter that says that all is all going to the Hunter Morris Fund. I do want to tell you as well that we're going to be processing, because the Morrises can't take credit cards. We'll process the credit card donations for them if you want to make those credit card donations online. We've sent out an email that has become a viral email. It's actually gone a little crazy. People are forwarding it to friends, and we're getting donations from across the world from people we don't know. We hope you join that. And if you go to that site, copy the link and email it to all your friends, because maybe we can make a difference. And like I said, those of us who eat so well can help out a kid and a family who can't. When we come back, we're going to be talking with a winemaker who was recently mentioned in the New York Times and will soon be at stage left for a wine dinner about some of her wines that have become in some ways a little controversial out in California. We're going to be talking with our friend Kathy Corson in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:16.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants. We were talking before the break about a fundraiser for this kid, Hunter Morris, who can't really eat food, and we're going to be hosting a fundraiser. We got a lot of calls during the break, people asking me to give out those phone numbers and that website again if you want to come to the fundraiser. Catherine Lombardi is 732-296-9463. If you want to learn about Hunter and his disease and how you can help and even donate online, you can go to the huntermorrisfund.com. We've linked you to there from CatherineLombardi.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Help us out. Do something good. Even if you can just send $10. We're processing all the credit card donations. It would be great. And if you can email it to some friends, that would be even better. Now, joining us today is Kathy Corison. Kathy's one of our favorite winemakers, has been for a long time. She joins us from her home in Napa.
Kathy, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys.
How have you been?
Terrific.
When last we met, Kathy, you were... When last we saw each other, you were doing an event at Salon in New York City, and I believe you'd been on your feet for about 19 and a half hours in a row, pouring wine for throngs of people.
The Energizer Buddy.
You know, actually, I have to say, last time Mark and I were out in California, we decided to stop and visit Kathy shortly after she'd built her new winemaking facility in sort of a retro barn. We stopped by, and we had made an appointment by phone to be there, of course, and then we got there, and there were no handles on the doors, and Mark and I sort of walked around the barn for a little while. Did those handles ever come in?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they've been on for years now.
I was going to say that wasn't you trying to tell us something by not having them there. So, Kathy will be doing, if you want to meet Kathy and try her wines, Kathy's going to be doing a wine dinner at Stage Left on Tuesday, February 13th. It's sort of a preemptive strike on Valentine's Day. We're going to be pouring several vintages of Cabernet Sauvignon. Now, Kathy, you make in Napa only Cabernet Sauvignon, right?
Pretty much. I goof around on a home winemaking scale with a couple of other things, like the Alsatian-style Gewürztraminer, but there are only 100 cases of that. My letterhead says Corison Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon, and that's what I do.
Well, we've had your wines from your first vintage on our wine list, and one of the things that strikes me about Corison wines, and I've gotten into debates with people about this, is we try to have a vertical selection, which means in wine speak, that means we have a number of different vintages of the same wine, you know, going back in time on our wine list. And I find that your wines age pretty well. And contrary to popular misconception, I think most Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon does not age as well as yours. Why do you think your wine ages better than most?
Well,
and do you agree that it does?
Absolutely. It develops and does interesting things for decades in the bottle. And my first vintage was 1987, so I've made 20 vintages, and it's still developing nicely. It's part of my mission, really. I want to make wines that are both powerful and elegant, and I want them to be structured to have a long, interesting life, because there are things that happen in the bottle that make the wine more interesting and aromatic that you simply can't get any other way. You just have to be patient.
Kathy, why don't you talk about wine structure? I think maybe some of our listeners don't know exactly what you're talking about when you say that.
Structure is the things other than flavors. The flavors are hung on the structure, and the structural elements in a wine are the tannins.
Which is the bitterness quality.
Well, more astringent.
Astringent,
really.
Right. That's not
it's like a strong tea has a lot of tannin, and that dryness is from tannin. Wine has tannins. It has pigments, the colors. It has natural acids from the grapes. And then the alcohol is also a component of structure. Those are all the things that you feel more than you taste, I think.
Well, let's talk about alcohol for a second. Your wines tend to have less alcohol than some of the other well-known, you know, high-scoring
California cabs.
I mean, your wines are 13, 13.5% alcohol. Some of these wines are 15, 15.5% alcohol, which is a huge difference. Why do you choose to make wines with a lower alcohol content?
Because I choose to pick my grapes earlier because of several reasons. One, I don't want wines with high alcohol. I want them to grace the table and go well with foods. I want to pick them when they still have all the beautiful red and blue fruits cherries, blueberries, as well as the plums and blackberries that evolve as the grapes get riper. So I like to pick them at a point where there's a very wide range, a very complex range of fruit flavors. That's important to my style. I also want to pick them while there's still good natural acidity. As the grapes get riper, the acidity drops. And so that's one other thing I keep my eye on is being sure that I have good natural acidity for balance.
Now, Kathy, I mean, you obviously planned from early on to have wines that were age-worthy. You planned to have wines that could last decades. And one of the reasons that I think we know that is because you have back vintages of some of these wines. You've kept a library of a lot of these wines. We see you releasing back vintages of 95 Cabernet just a year or two ago.
Which is unusual in California.
Very, very. And I guess that's the point I want to make. I mean, most young winemakers, as they're starting up their wineries in the first 10 years, you see very little of their older vintages because, A, they haven't planned fiscally for it, but, B, I think maybe they're not interested in seeing what their wines are doing 20 years later. Was that kind of part of the original plan to build a library of these wines to see what they were like 20 years later?
Absolutely, and it's hard to do. It took a few years before I got good at it. I had to stop selling it sooner than I thought I needed to because there's always some slides. So, yes, absolutely. I want to be able to watch these wines throughout my life. I also bottle in bigger bottles for that reason, too, mostly for my library. I put up magnums. Those are commercially available. But I also put up 3 liters and larger bottles.
These are double, triple, and quadruple bottles.
Yeah, they'll age much more slowly.
Mm-hmm.
When we
actually, Paul Hobbs put up some 9-liter bottles for us to do exactly with that. Do that with try in 20, 25 years.
When we come back, I want to talk with the listening audience because I think a lot of people may not even drink wine, but it's fascinating. When we talk about aging wine, wine is one of those few things that you age even more than a spirit, and certainly we don't age our grape juice or our soda at home. But when we come back, Kathy, will you talk to us about what happens to a bottle of wine as it ages that makes it interesting?
Of course.
We'll be back in just a moment talking with Kathy Corrison from Napa Valley, one of our favorite California Cabernet makers. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant. Again, I'm giving out that website if you want to find out about our fundraiser for Hunter Morris. Hunter Morris is a kid who can't eat food, and we're going to have a fundraiser for him at Kathleen Lombardi. You can go to KatherineLombardi.com or RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
And a great wine auction with wines donated by great winemakers like Kathy Corrison.
And the HunterMorrisFund.com. So, Kathy, we were talking before the break about how your wines are particularly age-worthy for California wines. And I find that a lot of these very expensive, very high-scoring California Cabernets, to me, they don't age. And what I mean by that is they don't go bad, but to me, they don't change. They taste the same 10 years old as they did 2 years old. Or
the fruit dries out. Sometimes they do go bad.
But your wines actually change and evolve in the bottle. They're designed to age. What is it that happens in a bottle of wine over time that makes it different? You're a chemist.
I am a chemist, but it's really alchemy, and I've got to admit that nobody understands it very well. We do know that wine is such a complex mixture of things that over time, their things combine and recombine, and they make things that weren't there before. Often they're aromatic things. Often they're floral, perfume notes. There's also a softening that goes on in the bottle. The tannins, which can be astringent when they're young, will combine into bigger molecules, and they'll still be there, but they'll feel softer in the mouth.
When we talk about aging wines, one of the things that, because I teach a lot of classes, I'm actually in the middle of teaching a consumer course right now, but we do a lot of like corporate icebreakers and wine tastings for consumers. And on the basic level, one of the things that I always try to do for the students is to pour a young wine and then an older example and a much older example of that same wine. Mm. And one of the things that I think is so interesting is that you begin to get notes of things, and we talk about what things smell and taste like, and they say, oh, well, you know, it's beginning to smell like resin or tobacco or cedar. And those things aren't in the wine. It's just grape juice. But it all sort of speaks to that we're all made of the same stuff, you know, and it's very elemental, you know. So I think, to me, that's the romance of aging wine, is when you see something like that happen. It's sort of it's been described as a controlled process of decay. Is that accurate?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think that it's an evolution. I mean, any wine is going to at some point go over the edge and be too old, and you might call that decay. But no, I think of it more as a continuum, and it's, you know, wine for me is alive. Wine has a life just like people, and interesting people have ups and downs, and great people are great throughout their lives, even when they're young and even when they're arguably, you know, past their prime. They're still interesting, and I think of a great wine the same way.
When we come back from the news, we're going to talk more with Kathy Corrison. She is an interesting and great person with interesting and great wines, and we're going to taste her Cabernet Sauvignons from the 96, the 98, the 2001 vintage, all with her the day before Valentine's Day. So if you want to be really cool, come out the day before Valentine's Day, surprise your boyfriend and girlfriend, and come down to Stage Left Restaurant. You can find out about it on our website. We'll be back after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, our guest is Kathy Corrison. Kathy is a great winemaker from California. We have a vertical selection of her wines on our wine list, all Cabernet Sauvignon from all her years back to 91, I think, is the first one we put on our list. She'll be in town on February 13th, the day before Valentine's Day, to do a dinner at one of our restaurants at Stage Left Restaurant, if you want to come to the dinner. You can go to stageleft.com, click on events, and you can find out how to do that and meet Kathy herself. Kathy, this dinner was prompted by an article that I read in the New York Times that made me mad. And I put down the paper and I picked up the phone and I called you and I said, please come out to Jersey and let's do a dinner again. Can we talk about that article?
Sure.
There's a guy named Michel Roland, and if you listen to the show we did, and if you're podcasting, you can check our archives for a show we did with a guy named Neil Rosenthal from the movie Mondo Vino, which is a great film, and Neil's a great wine importer. And sort of, if Neil was the hero or one of the heroes in that film, in that documentary,
then there was a villain.
The villain was a guy named Michel Roland, and it was not just about Michel Roland, but it was about this new style of winemaking, where the documentary did sort of point the finger at Roland as being a guy who goes all across the world and teaches people how to make big, powerful, alcoholic wines that get a lot of scores and make a lot of money.
And taste like everything else.
And to me and Mark, we always feel they taste the same. And we also feel that they don't age particularly well. But it's sort of like the globalization of wine at the expense of, you know, unique and individual places. Well, let me read to you from the article. The article is by, who wrote the article? It was Eric Asimov, who we've also had on the show. He said, "We spoke with Roland about the rising levels of alcohol in wines and the trends toward allowing grapes to ripen longer before they're harvested. The resulting wines are bigger and more opulent with sweeter fruit, softer tannins, and an absence of herbal flavors that were once commonplace in Cabernet Sauvignon. I mention Clos du Val and Corison, two Napa Valley producers whose wines adhere to a less upfront, more austere style. And Mr. Roland is strikingly dismissive," he says. "Are they as successful in the marketplace?" "No," he said, warming to the subject. "Wine is done for what? The public? Wine is a business. They want to make wine to sell wine. In the U.S., they're honest enough to tell you that they want good ratings. They don't want loser wines. Kathy, are you a loser?"
No.
I read this.
It's interesting that I think it really boils down to how you define success to a very large extent.
Well, talk to us about that. How do you define success?
I just want to know. Hold on. Before you do that, I just want to know, did he make you as mad as he made us? Because we got all red-faced when we read this.
Oh, yeah. Mad and other emotions, too.
But go ahead.
First of all, I think it's important for us all to realize that there's room for all different styles of wine. And there are people that like wines made in his style. And there's no reason not to make wines well in that style. But what's important to me is to make wines that I prefer to drink. And for me, those are wines that are elegant. They're very powerful, but they're elegant at the same time. And I think sometimes that's more difficult to do.
I think you've hit upon a good point. My problem is not that Michel Roland advises people to make wine in a certain style. But my point is that, one of my large concerns is that too many people, because this is when you have Michel Roland's wines, they're very obvious. And you put your nose in the glass and go, wow, that's a wine, you know, because they're powerful. But very often they lack finesse and subtlety. But when power becomes the only goal, when operating on the simplest level becomes the only goal, sometimes these little regions of France and Italy are losing their individual character to make these powerful wines. But what struck me about this article was not that Roland, that this guy is making wine in a certain way, but that here he himself is disparaging anyone who makes any wine in a different way than his. And I don't care for that. That made me very, very upset.
I guess that's what upset us. His way was the only way, and everybody else was wrong.
And that's discouraging. But, you know, he's and if you want to talk about success purely in a commercial way, I just made my 20th vintage, mm-hmm. and I sell all my wines. There are people all over the country that collect my wines. So, you know, I simply... I think it boils down to how you define success.
McDonald's makes more money than Mark and
that's
for
right.
Sure, you know, and yeah. But I don't want to do that.
I guess the question that I need to ask you, though, Kathy, is Roland ruining it, or is he just reacting to public preferences, like he says?
Well, I think he's reacting to public preferences, but there's never been a pendulum that only swings one way.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I have been in the wine business long enough to have seen this pendulum swing back and forth more than once. And I think we're mid-swing all the way back. I think there's a big sea change, and I think people are making wines and demanding wines that are more elegant and have more finesse.
Kathy, here.
What I'm about to say is, the very next question I was going to ask you is there a backlash to Roland and these wines that are being made in this kind of singular style?
Well, there's certainly a swing back to wines with more finesse, I think. And that doesn't mean that there's not still a place for wines made in that style. It's just that I think for all of our sake, we want to be sure we don't lose the diversity of choices.
I love that you put it that way, because we do. I mean, Francis and I have 1,000 bottles on our list, and some of them are in that style, in Roland's style of winemaking.
A couple,
but you know, first of all, we don't feel that they go great with food. But okay, there's a place. You have a small place on our grand list, but it's not the be-all, end-all.
Let me tell you where I think the world of wine is going, and you've traveled all around the country with your own wines, and you read the same as we do, the same publications we do. It strikes me that, you know, having done this now for 20 years on the retail side of things and on the restaurant side of things, it goes like this. The trend starts with uber eggheads who are you know, the people who study about wine. It percolates down to, like, the top sommeliers in New York, and then it percolates down to, like, the cool kids who are studying, who want to do the they want to make a name for themselves. They want to like what's not widely available, and so they're constantly looking for the new stuff. And so in the mid 80s, people were looking for the more and more powerful wine, the more and more strong wine, the more and more striking big oaky wine. And now what I'm seeing is, among that sort of wine geek class, which I say with no disparaging remarks because I hopefully am a member of it.
Oh, I think you are.
The people who are in that category of wine buyer, wine professional, are saying, these are the wines I love. And that's how, you know, Austrian wines were popular with those people 3 years before they were in the regular market, and now they're throughout the whole market. And right now, in that class of people, people are looking for wines like Coruscant wines, age-worthy wines, wines with subtlety and finesse. Is that your read of where the marketplace is, Kathy?
Not a day goes by that somebody doesn't thank me for sticking with my style, which is elegant wines. It's in the air.
Well, today there are two people thanking you.
Yeah, and it's on the air today, actually, as a matter of fact. Now, let me ask you one more thing. We only have a couple of minutes left, but you're also concerned with, now you make wines in Napa Valley, but you made wines in Napa Valley for over 20 years now.
30 years.
Oh my goodness. Well, that's over 20. But one of the things you're concerned with that a lot of Americans don't realize, that we teach in our classes all the time, and I'm always amazed that it really opens, people love to learn this in a consumer class, that there are different areas of Napa that have that impart different flavors to wine. This is not different grapes I'm talking about, but different regions within the Napa Valley. And you can't really see those with those big, powerful wines, but in wines in your style, you can see the different flavors that are imparted from different parts of Napa. Can you talk to us about the different parts of Napa and how they can make a difference in wines?
Well, that's another reason not to pick grapes at a very high sugar, in my opinion. Because I think if you pick grapes while they still have the typical flavors, you see the terroir or the soil or the area that the grapes come from. And it's not just the Napa Valley, it's all over the world. If grapes get ripe enough, I find it hard to not only tell where it's coming from, but even tell what variety it is. Because once they get to a certain point, there's a prune character that takes over in any red grape. So the Napa Valley is very diverse. They're very old soils, very diverse soils, and that's the reason why so many different wines come out of the Napa Valley. Wine would be very boring if it were all the same. I think it's one of the wonderful things about wine is that it varies place to place, it varies winemaker to winemaker, and then it varies over time. It has a life.
Well, now, I'm going to tell you, we only have about a minute left, but you're coming to do a winemaker with us the day before Valentine's Day, February 13th. How do you like showing your wines with food? I mean, is this an important thing?
And another one of my missions is to keep the table in table wine.
Yeah.
And
nice.
That means that I want my wines to be balanced and elegant so that they make food taste better and then the food makes the wine taste better. And anybody that's ever experienced that knows it's magic.
Well, come and meet Kathy Coruscant, and you can have the food and the wine and us and Kathy all in a room together. You can find out how to do that at stageleft.com or restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Kathy, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is...
Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis is stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Saying one of the things I like about calling California early in the morning is it's 8 a.m. there. So, you know, Kathy, just like us, just had her first cup of coffee. She's just kind of
right, but that's how you can't
embracing
get,
her day.
That's why you can't get California restaurateurs out there.
That's
you know,
true.
What's funny is, I mean, this was kind of a geeky show today. I mean, the wine stuff was kind of geeky, wine geeky. But
well, anytime you do most of the talking, that's how it comes out.
No, but I mean, you know what I mean. It was a little esoteric. But, you know, making wines that age, just like making traditional foods, just like making traditional products, just like going to a restaurant that's owned by an individual, these are things that we could lose. You could lose it all to the Walmart and the two-buck chuck, okay? That's where it could all go.
And
so
we
have to preserve it.
The other thing you have to realize with as far as these geeky things, if we want to preserve the artisanal kinds of things in the world and the best of the best, well, okay, those people are really involved in what they're doing. They're 100%. They throw themselves into it 100%. And sometimes Mark and Francis are a little geeky about things because they've thrown themselves 100% into something.
And what corporations do is they make things as explicable as possible. And there's an adage that says something like, if you have a bad, if you have the losing side of the argument, but you can explain your position in one sentence, but the winning side of the argument needs to take three sentences, you always win.
Mm-hmm.
And so what these corporations do is they make it very simple. And I thank you all for listening to us talk about this stuff because it is important, and it's the subtlety and nuance that makes individuals. That's the reason you go to even your local diner that's owned by a person rather than the Denny's. It's the reason that you go to a great, you know, local high-end restaurant rather than the Olive Garden. It's the differences are in the details.
I thought it just was because it tasted better.
Well, exactly.
Is that one of the details,
but we got an hour to fill 5 days a week telling people why it tastes better. Anyway, if you want to meet Kathy Corrison, you can find out information on her on restaurantguysradio.com. We'll link you to stageleft.com.
She's coming February 13th. We have this Hunter Morris Fund fundraiser on February the 19th, which is President's Day. It's Monday President's
Day. Here's our final plea. Go to HunterMorrisFund.com. You can link there from restaurantguysradio.com. or KatherineLombardi.com. Find out about this kid. Email your friends. Make a donation, and let's make a difference in a middle-class family's life who's trying to stay afloat. You can really do some good here, and we'd appreciate it if you'd help us out. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Chalk.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.